He was name-checked by Jack Kerouac and nicknamed the Prez by Billie Holiday. Lester Young epitomized the jazz hipster. This is Siddhartha Mitter. I'm filling in for John Schaefer. Lester Young revolutionized the tenor saxophone, playing solos that floated above the time of the band, like on Lester Leaps In, which you're hearing right now. But privately, Prez suffered from acute depression and alcoholism, which tragically ended his life at age 49. Dave Gelly is the jazz critic for The Observer in London, and he's the author of the new biography, Being Prez, and he joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Dave, welcome to Soundcheck.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you. There's nearly a dozen bios, or some large number of bios on Lester Young already, as you mentioned in the beginning of your own book. What's so special about Lester Young that causes people to delve back and write about him and attracted you to write about him?
I think he's one of the most important jazz musicians of the 20th century, because he actually invented a way of playing which had the tenor saxophone, which had never been even born or thought of before, and in so doing, he managed to inspire generations of later players, Stan Getz, Dexter Gordon, all dozens and dozens and dozens, all of whom could, in a sense, be called his disciples.
Well, you refer to the way that he plays his solos as telling a story. What is the kind of story that Lester Young brings?
To begin with, in his early days, it was a cheerful story. He was a very buoyant player and a bubbly, buoyant musical line. As the vicissitudes of life pressed in on him, though, his playing became darker. The story that it told became much more complicated, more, in some respects, it became more subtle. And he touched on the sort of things which jazz music rarely touched on previously. Uncertainty, hope allayed by experience, a feeling of perhaps not being entirely at home in the world, you know, whereas previously jazz had been about being happy or being sad.
Well, let's put Lester Young a little bit in context for people who might have heard the name but not know much about him. Tell us when he emerges onto the jazz scene and what the jazz world looks like and that he brings, what he brings that's different to that at that time.
The curious thing about it was that he was born in 1909, but he didn't actually get into a recording studio until the end of 1936. So he was 27 years old before he even got near a recording microphone. So that means half his life was lived in what would now be called obscurity, because the only people who heard him were the people who happened to be sitting in front of him at the time when he was playing. So what we hear of Lester Young is from the early maturity until the death, which is most unusual. I mean, most jazz musicians start young and they get recorded young, but he didn't.
And he appears and plays in other people's bands, not so much under his own name at first. He plays
That's
with Count
true.
Basie.
That's right. Yes, he did. He first appeared with Count Basie's first orchestra. And a lot of his finest solo work is actually with Basie. He stayed with Basie until 1940 when he left. But even when he was with Basie, he was also recording with Billie Holiday and with other people. He had great difficulty. He was not one of nature's band leaders. He was not a leader of men by any manner of means. He felt happy. He was a shy man. It's unusual for a performer who's shy, but he felt happier inside somebody else's band, and his first attempt at band leading was a complete flop. But later in life, he managed to get himself managers and things like that that looked after him.
Well, you're a jazz saxophonist yourself, is that right?
I am, yes.
So you have sort of a privileged position for analyzing his music. In a second, we're going to hear a clip that epitomizes his work. But let's talk for a second about Coleman Hawkins. Is the big saxophone name at the time that Lester Young appears, and he's called upon to play like Coleman, and he doesn't want to do that, right? Tell us a bit about Coleman Hawkins, and then we'll go to a clip from Lester
Coleman
Young
Hawkins.
In a second.
Yes, well, Coleman Hawkins was a very confident man. I mean, he was one of these people who would ride over any difficulty. He was a confident person. And his music sounds exactly like that. There's no standing. You can't stand in the way of Coleman Hawkins. He was sure what he was doing. He played that way. He was a dominant individual. Lester Young was the exact opposite. He was shy. He was retiring. He was uncertain of himself. But he was happy in himself. But when he was young, but not in any way a domineering personality. And he would shrink away from any trouble or difficulty or anything. He would just walk away from it. That's the basis of the difference between the two. Hawkins invented the tenor saxophone as a jazz instrument. I mean, there were no tenor saxophone players of any weight before Hawkins turned up. And everybody in the world said, that's what the tenor saxophone is supposed to sound like. It sounds like Coleman Hawkins. Then along 1936-37 comes this other thing which people think, well, what's this? This isn't what saxophone's supposed to sound like at all.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that that other thing. It's 1938, and here's this song called "Jump In at the Woodside." Lester Young doing "Jumpin' at the Woodside," and we're talking with Dave Gelly, who has a new biography of the tenor saxophonist Lester Young called "Being Prez." Dave Gelly, when you hear a song like that, or when audiences at the time heard a song like that, what's revolutionary going on there with Lester Young?
Well, what's revolutionary is that it's not the way it was done before. As I say, I mean, everybody thought it the way it was supposed to be done was the way that Coleman Hawkins was supposed to did it, and they thought that was what it was supposed the way it was supposed to be done. Lester did it differently. That was actually not entirely typical of young Lester Young, but he was much more, his playing was much more delicate. It didn't roll forward. It sort of floated. Interestingly enough, the people who picked up on it were very young people, so that the Lester Young's first fans and there was a famous saxophone player who died not all that long ago called Al Cohn, and I remember him saying that when he was 13 years old, he heard Lester Young for the first time on a record, and he said, it was the hippiest thing I ever heard, and it changed my life. And a lot of people said that. Stan Getz said something very similar, because it seemed to It appealed to very young people at the time, and that was in the late 30s, early 40s.
Well, one fan that Lester Young found, and this is one of the most famous things, I guess, about him, is Billie Holiday. And right. So he forms this relationship with her over a number of years. And as you point out in the book, the one thing that people agree on is that it was a platonic relationship. But it was, at the same time, a very, very deep relationship, was it not?
It was, yes. It was a very deep relationship. It was very curious because... although he was somewhat older and more, and had been in the music business for all his life practically, she treated him rather like a sort of recalcitrant younger brother, and she sort of always tried to look after him, and she stood up for him when there were arguments and so on. There was no romance between them because she went for dominant type of men, and Lester wasn't like that.
You portray him as someone who's really quite introverted or awkward and so on. And is this what makes Lester Young also mysterious, that he seemed mysterious to outsiders because he had so much internal conflict?
He seemed mysterious to people because I think he made himself mysterious. I mean, he carried on in the most peculiar way. For instance, he invented words. I mean, he was the first man, probably the first man to use "cool" as a term of approbation, for instance, and he used a whole lot of phrases and terms. He used "eyes" for something meant that you liked it, you know, and bells meant that you enjoyed it. And he had all these words that he used that if you didn't know Lester, you'd think he was talking practically a foreign language. Also, he used to wear this extraordinary wide-brim pork pie hat.
The famous pork pie hat, the emblem.
And, often wear dark glasses and big long overcoats.
And so this is the character who had this close friendship with Billie Holiday. I want to play a little bit of the two of them working together, Billie Holiday and Lester Young's saxophone, Me, Myself, and I.
Me, myself, and I are all in love with you. We all think you're wonderful, we do. Me, myself, and I have just one point of view. We're convinced there's no one else like you. It can't be denied, dear, you. We'd be satisfied, dear, if you belong to one of us. So if you pass me by, three hearts will break in two. 'Cause me, myself, and I are all in love with you.
We're talking to Dave Gelly, the author of Being Prez, the biographer of the great tenor saxophonist Lester Young. And we just heard Billie Holiday and Lester Young together doing Me, Myself, and I. Dave Gelly, one of the legacies of the relationship between, of the friendship between Billie Holiday and Lester Young is the nicknames, that she's the one who called him Prez, and he's the one who called her Lady Day.
He did. He called her Lady Day. Actually, he called everybody ladies. I mean, it got to the point when everybody was called Lady something. But she was the first. He called her Lady Day for Billie Holiday.
Why does she call him Prez for president?
Because she said the most. She said you've got Earl Hines and you've got Count Basie and you've got King this and that. She said, but the biggest man in the United States is the president. So I'm going to call you the president, and that got shortened to Prez.
And later on in life, another incredible parallel that exists between them is that they go into the later phases of their life at the same, you know, in the same time, and they pass away not that far off from each other. What is there a parallel decline or a parallel tragic story that the two of them share in the 1950s?
They suffered from different things. Lester Young suffered a number of psychic shocks in his life. He was abducted from his mother by his father and taken into his father's traveling band when he was 10 years old, which was a shock to start with. And he was then inducted into the army at the age of 35. Ended up in a military prison,
and that seems very strange. 35 would have been quite an old age to be inducted in, and he was also not in any kind of physical shape.
He was actually too old. I mean, it's a mystery what happened. He went in. He admitted quite freely that he used to smoke cannabis and he used to drink a lot of whiskey and so on. He was spectacularly unfit. They discovered that he had all sorts of things wrong with him, but they still took him in. And in the book I say, it seems that the thing was they just got fed up with people trying to dodge the draft, and they were going to make an exhibition of somebody, make an example of somebody, and they just happened to settle on him.
And he ends up in court-martialed and in detention.
That's right. He actually admitted. They said, "You're looking a bit peculiar." He said, "Well, you know, I'm high." And they said, "How did you get like that?" He said, "Well, I got this stuff," and they court-martialed him and sent him to a military prison.
And so he spends the rest of World War II in a prison in Georgia.
Yeah, well, it wasn't as long as that. I mean, he didn't go in until right at the end of 44. So he wasn't actually in military prison for more than about 8 months. But it was enough to it made him very withdrawn. It made him suspicious, particularly of people he didn't know, and particularly of white people he didn't know. If he knew you were all right, but if he didn't, he became very nervous, and it gradually got to the point when he didn't really like to meet people at all. Even meeting audiences was a problem to him after a bit.
As you point out in the book, when Lester Young comes out of detention and the war is over and he emerges into what ends up being the final period of his career, these experiences have had an impact that tracks in his music. And one of the pieces that he composes afterwards is called Detention Barracks Blues, or DB yeah. Blues for Detention
DB
Barracks Blues.
Blues.
Let's hear a little bit of that clip.
Yeah.
Lester Young, DB Blues, after he came out of detention during World War II. We're talking to Dave Gelly, the author of Being Prez, the new biography of the tenor saxophonist Lester Young. I'm Siddhartha Mitter, sitting in for John Schaefer, and you're listening to Soundcheck. Dave Gelly, Lester Young in the 1950s, this is the final part of his career. And the 1950s is this incredible period of time in jazz where so many of the classic musicians are nurtured and bebop is growing and transforming and people like Miles and Coltrane are appearing. What is Lester Young's music at this time and what does he contribute at this time?
Well, he was playing very, very well for a lot of the 1950s. The idea that Lester Young was a broken man when he came out of the army and never played a decent note is just nonsense. I mean, that was beautiful, that DB Blues. And he'd only just come out of the army. He hadn't played for about, you know, best part of a year. But towards the end, right at the end of his life, he was ill. He couldn't breathe properly. He had a lot of stuff wrong with him. And he lost a lot of his will, and he had nervous breakdowns and things. But before that, in the from 1946 right through until the mid 50s, he was sometimes playing quite magnificently, and a lot of the people around at the time agreed too. I mean, he was voted by other musicians in a poll, I think, as the greatest tenor saxophone player of the ever or some such thing, you know. But I mean, it means to say that other musicians recognise what a great figure he was.
And that contrasts with the extent to which he's somewhat of a forgotten figure in the jazz pantheon today. What is it that we take for granted in jazz or in some streams of jazz that we really owe to Lester Young, in your opinion?
I think one thing is delicacy. And because with Lester, some of the most beautiful things, the things which tiny, tiny little nuances in a phrase will do it, you know. I think that kind of delicacy is not really prized very much nowadays. The last really delicate, famous jazz musician there was apart from Miles Davis, was probably Stan Getz. For the tenor saxophone, anyway, was Stan Getz. That kind of... clarity, really, of thought and expression and delicacy of feeling, I think, are the things we perhaps have passed away a little bit in jazz.
As a saxophonist and a lover of the music, what's your personal connection to Lester Young? Was it a labor of love? What is it that impelled you to invest all this time in studying this one character?
Well, I sort of fell for Lester when I was a teenager. I mean, I'm approaching the old 70 at the moment, and I fell for Lester Young when I was about 16. I've always loved Lester's playing, and all the other people that followed from Lester, like Zoot Sims and Stan Getz and people like that, are also favourites of mine. And I think the thing that I like about them and the things that originally I liked about Lester, it's just his way of being, really, which is sort of the opposite of the steamroller, you know, Coleman Hawkins, you know, go and get 'em approach. It's more subtle and a little bit more sneaky, and I just love it.
The great tenor saxophonist Lester Young, who died in 1959, and we've been talking to Dave Gelly. He is the jazz critic for The Observer in London, and he is the author of a new book called Being Prez: The Life and Music of Lester Young, with Oxford University Press. And Dave Gelly, as we head out, we're going to hear one of perhaps the most famous tributes to Lester Young that there is, which is Charles Mingus doing Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. Dave Gelly, thank you so much for joining us on Soundcheck.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And John Schaefer and our staff are in Berlin this week. They're collecting material for the Soundcheck on Site series that begins next Monday. But you can get a sneak preview of their adventures in Berlin on a special blog. Go to the Soundcheck page at wnyc.org and you can follow their adventures. This is Soundcheck.